Yeah, sorry, you'll agree that my forebears, and especially my grandfather, was one of the early settlers in the southeastern area. And so I'll start back maybe with a little biography of my grandparents and how they came to Alaska and how my mother and dad happened to meet and live here all their lives, and what they begat in the way of children, and some observations from my meager 50 years residence. I guess it starts back with my grandfather, Nick King. He was born in Essen, Germany, about 1854, as close as I can figure. And back in those days, they had conscription in the German army, and his parents, having lost, I think, two or three older brothers, decided that they'd spirit Nick out of the country. And he had relatives over in California, and so they got him out just before he was of the draft age to be taken into Bismarck's German army. And got him passage on a windjammer, and he went around to the Horn and up to California, and that was about 1870, as far as I can trace back. And so he arrived and went to work there in some of the mills up on Sutter Creek in the Sacramento Valley, and apprenticed out and learned the mill trade. So that's phase one. About the same time, a little Irish girl over in Ireland, by the name of Alice Devlin, decided to migrate to the New World. She had relatives both in Boston and out in California, and so after a short stay in Boston, she went cross-country, and the railroads were already in, and so she arrived in California and wound up in the neighboring area to where Nick King, the fellow from Germany, was. Well, she spoke no German, but he was learning English pretty well, and in spite of her Irish accent, I guess they communicated somehow. At any rate, they were married and lived, I suppose, about 5 years there before he heard the got a bid to come to Alaska. Now, what was going on in Alaska about that time? Well, this was about 1880, and there were, of course, settlers over in Sitka, and there were settlers in Wrangell, and there was quite a bit of prospecting going on up and down the coast. And there was no government here yet. The Navy was in control at that time, and there was the cutter Jamestown was at Sitka, and they had some mining engineers up there doing prospecting work, and one of them, I think, by the name of Fitz, I looked it up here not so long ago, sent a couple of fellows by the name of Joe Harris, Joe Juno, and Dick Harris, up to Gastineau Channel, because some of the Indians from Taku and Auk Bay had brought him samples, and he was a mining engineer, and he sent these two fellows then up into Gastineau Channel to see what where these samples had come from. So Joe Juno and Dick Harris got up there in what is now called the Silver Bowl Basin, and they made a pretty good discovery, and they staked it out, and that was in 1882. The town was actually called Harrisburg first, as Frank, I think, will testify, and I find also that it was called Rockwell and Pittsburgh at Pillsburg at one time. But at any rate, in 1882, it was officially named Juno. And just that about that same time, a Frenchman by the name of French Pete, his real name was Pete, E-R-U-S-S-A-R-D, went across to Douglas Island, and he got some pretty good colors, but he was a happy-go-lucky sort of fella, and he wanted some ready cash. And he sold his claim to a carpenter by the name of John Treadwell in 1881, and Treadwell was smart enough to raise capital and start getting an organization to take some of this gold out of the ground. And they sent to California for experienced mill men. And one of the mill men that they picked up was my grandfather, Nick King. And so he came up in about 1883, as close as I can trace, to be the foreman of the first mill that they were going to build for the Treadwell Company. And as things went along then, he stayed there two or three years, and finally he sent for the family. And my mother was a little child of five when she arrived. She hadn't seen her daddy for something like 3 years. And my grandmother, the little Irish lady, she came along. And in those days, believe me, there wasn't much. It was pretty barren. And they My mother would recall how the boat, I believe it was the City of Seattle was the name of the boat, would stop out in front of the town, and they lightered them off in a rowboat and took them to town. There weren't many white settlers there at the time, but there was one, and some of you know him, probably some of you recall Oliver Anderson, who ran a little delicatessen down here for a while, and he still makes the rounds as a salesman up and down the river and did freighting along the Husqvarna for some time. And, well, there wasn't much in the way of school. There were some mission schools, like that's all there was in Alaska at that time. And in Douglas happened to have a Society of Friends had a school. So my mother started school there for this mission school. And a few years later then, she went over to Juneau, where the Sisters of St. Anne had established a convent and a hospital. In 1886, they started St. Anne's Hospital in Juneau. And so then she went on for several more years to school over there. So, let's go back and see where my father came from. There was my mother. My father was born back in Ishpeming, Michigan, one of a family of about 11. And his oldest sister married a fellow by the name of John Penglaze. And Penglaze was a blacksmith, and he was recruited from the Michigan mines to come out and take over a job in the Treadwell too, as a skilled workman, of course, were being recruited in most of the mining areas, I suppose, in the West. So he came out and sent then for his wife and children, and his wife happened to be one of my father's older sister, and he came out with his sister then and helped out the children. And he was 21 years of age when he arrived. I've got it dashed down here. I tried to get it straightened out today. 1894 he came, at the age of 21. And his trade was a blacksmith, and so he went to work in the Treadwell as a blacksmith and drill sharpener. And a few years later, in 1901, why he and my mother, whose name was Sadie King, were married in Douglas in 1901 then. And here's an interesting sideline. After the wedding, that evening they had a big dance up in Holman's Hall. And they had orchestra and dancing and a great big spread of food and everything. And one of the musicians that were playing at the dance that night was a young fellow by the name of Carl Erickson. And he was 16 years of age at the time. And Carl Erickson is still playing the slide trombone for the Pioneers Band. If you went to the Pioneers Affair and Carl Erickson there, the old gentleman with the slide trombone, every time he sees me, he says, "I played at your mother and dad's wedding celebration." And so he's still getting along. Well, Douglas, this was on the Douglas side. There are quite a few that migrated from that area. Bobby McKenna was an early day Douglasite. Merle Thomas is someone we have to get here, because Merle Thomas has the best collection of the Juneau Douglas Treadwell era of anyone I know of. Mrs. Dixie Hall, her maiden name was Esther Oliver. She was raised in Douglas. And there are quite a few up in interior that had their beginnings and early days down there. The Treadwell, of course, in Douglas mines prospered. And as time went on, the town grew. And I have a few little notes here and statistics, if I can find them here at the moment. Eventually, the Treadwell mine became the second largest gold producer in the whole world. It took out before it finally caved in, and I'll tell about that a little bit, as I recall it. In 1917, when it was finally caved in, I read one place where it had already paid back nine times the purchase price. So if you can multiply 7,200,000 by nine, you'll know how much gold the Treadwell mines had produced. Right along, just about with the Treadwell mines, the Alaska Juneau was going along fine too. And remember, this was real hard rock, although they were doing some placer work on the creeks around there, and they were doing some very treacherous mining. I don't know whether any of you have been down that area, but that glory hole that Frank might be able to talk, they would mine by putting men down on ropes and drilling in, and I don't know what all they did. But the big pay was the deep quartz veins that they had to go down under the channel and go out miles and miles of tunneling and bring the ore up to the surface, put it in these tremendous stamp mills. The 240 stamp mill was one of the wonders of the world. It shook the whole area for years and years. And it was a big producer. And they had as many as 2,000 men working down there. And as my early memories, of course, I was born in 1914 in the cave-in, as I will mention later, happened in 1917. But I have a few very early recollections of the town. One of the things I remember is the funerals. They were losing miners very fast because the safety precautions were very elementary, I suppose. And apparently men were quite expendable because there were shiploads coming in with miners all the time, and then some of them would make a few dollars and move on, maybe some of them into the interior, some of them would go back to the States. But the funerals were quite remarkable. We lived right on the main street, and I remember as a child watching these funeral processions going by. And they'd have a band. Most of them were South European miners that they brought over from Yugoslavia, and the Croatians and Montenegrins, a lot of South Europeans were made up the bulk of the miners, as I recall. And they would all turn out to the funerals, all right. But they would play these funeral dirges going by the house, very slow tempo, horses draped in black and all that sort of thing. And then coming back, why, they'd let the music step up a little pace, and they'd all go down to the 13 bars along Front Street and kind of celebrate a little bit. But it was almost a daily occurrence to have some accident in the mines. And the shifts were pretty long. I think they started as 2 10-hour shifts a day, give them time between a little bit to do a little repair work. There were no holidays other than Christmas and 4th of July. And this happened, mind you, right in the AJ up until 1930, well, about 1930, when they were starting to, when they had a powder drift, that is, putting in a large blast, the gas from the explosion was coming back into the other workings, so that too many miners were becoming gassed and having sent to the hospital with gas. So they decided to give them a holiday when they had a powder drift. But my father continued to work there, first at the Treadwell and then at the Alaska Juno until his death in 1931. And he had no days off except 4th of July and Christmas and powder blast days. And of course, wages is hard to compare now with present day wages, but he was a skilled workman, and his wage at the time of his death was $165 a month, and he was pretty well paid because $120 was the labor standard. Well, I might touch just a little bit about the makeup of the community. As I look back on it, it was one of the most amazing towns, and I don't know if many towns in Alaska had quite the situation. But when you're in a mining community like that, you need skilled men, and you need hard-working men. And I think of all the melting pots, perhaps Douglas and to some extent probably also Juneau, had just about every nationality that you could name. Geography to me in going to school there was no mystery at all. Almost any country that you could name in Europe, there were first generation, or at least their parents had been born there, and the children could speak perhaps another language. There were Irish, McIntyres, Cashins, Dugans. There were English, the Pierces, the Garens, the Scotch families, Frasers, Edmistons, Gares, Says, German families, Reedies and the Galvises, French families, the Riandos, and there were a couple of other, Belgian families, the Stragers, the Italian families, the Bartolinis, the Geises, Mike Pusich, the Pusich family is still there, Austrians, Africh family, I recall, the Yugoslav families, Finnish families, Savikos, the Niemis, the Renikas, I could keep on naming them, Swedish families, the Lundells, and the Kronquists, and the Rundquists. And there was just about, as you go down the list of all the countries that you could think of, we had some people there that their parents were born in those countries. And they had come over to Alaska and to work in the mines. Of course, we had our Indian town, too. And so it was quite a polyglot society, I suppose. But we all got along amazingly well. And talk about hometowns, I don't know of any town where everybody knew everybody and respected them for what they were. Well, come 1917 then, and as the story goes, and perhaps Bobby Shelton and Frank Young would know the story better than I do. However, I remember my father coming in after he had gone to work and throwing his lunch bucket down on the table, and if you'll pardon his cursing, he said, and I wasn't too shocked, he said, 20 years of work shot to hell. The mine had caved in. Apparently they'd been down there and got too ambitious. There were certain rich veins that were on the ceiling, and they were stoping up, and they thought that, well, their engineering didn't tell them that the ocean was right up there. So they tried to take out some of that rich vein up in the ceiling, and the good old Pacific Ocean came in. That happened in April 1917, and they were never flooded so badly, and it was so catacombed over there, that actually there was a big slump, and those of you who've been around the area know the cave-in then, just a big long circular sloughing off there, houses hanging precariously on the hill. Strangely enough, there were no deaths. The slide, the cave-in, took place at a change of shift, and one man by the name of Tassel was the last one down there waiting for the skip to go up, and the water was coming in, and so they were, the last load coming off shift, were in a hurry. And apparently there was room for him, but he decided to go back, as one story has it, for his good luck charm, and the other one for his lunch pocket, so take your choice. At any rate, Tassel didn't make it, but all the others got to the surface and off the area before it finally slumped. Well, that was a kind of a death blow, and of course the people in the community went in many directions, some of them to Seattle, and some of them over to Kennecott that was looking for men at the time, many of them over to Anchorage. Those who couldn't afford to leave, I guess, like my folks, kind of stayed there and went to work at the Alaska Juno. And so the ferry boat then every morning would take the Douglas miners over to the Alaska Juno mine and then bring them back in the evening. And so most of the families were able to survive then by that working in Juno. So essentially we became one town after the cave-in. Connected by ferry boats until 1934, when the bridge was built across. That's pretty much it about my own family. Well, Sadie and Tom were married in 1901. They had 8 children, and I'm someplace in the middle. We're all still alive, and it might be of some historical interest to trace an Alaska family of that generation. Our ages vary from 40 to 60 now. And this is the way we stack up. My oldest sister, Frances, joined the sisterhood, the Sisters of St. Anne, when she was about 19 or 20. And she's been with the order all of her life. And she now teaches at Prince George, British Columbia, although she spent many years teaching in the mission there at Skagway. My next second eldest was my brother Tom. Some of you met him. He's banker in Juneau for the last 33 years, and he's treasurer of the Grand Igloo Pioneers of Alaska. He was up at our last convention here. My sister Cecile is Mrs. Ralph Mortensen. She lives in Gig Harbor, and her husband is a troller and comes up fishing in Southeastern every summer. My brother John lives in Everett, Washington. He's just had some difficulty with his eyes, and now he's convalescing at home, not employed at the time. And there's myself, next in line. My brother Gerald is a teacher in Parkland, Washington, and my two younger brothers, Frank and Harry, are accountants in Juneau. So half of us are still in Alaska, and half migrated to the lower 48, Puget Sound. In looking back, as far as Douglas, I mentioned the interesting number of people, varieties that we had there in town, and other, after the cave-in, of course, we thought everything happened to a town that could. There was no chance of reopening. There was a little cleanup work, and the foundry kept operating for many years, but didn't amount to much. Then we had a bad fire in 1926 that started just one end of town and swept all of the Treadwell area right to the ground. Maybe a half dozen houses left up on the hill, but essentially destroyed half the town, what was left of half the town. Many of the buildings, true enough, were abandoned and vacant, but just the same, swept it out. Suffered another bad fire in 1937 when it started down on Front Street and swept the middle of town. And so for many years, it looked that Douglas was on its last legs. I'm pleased to report that the little town has a lot of spirit and a lot of history there. It's making good comeback, especially since statehood. There's demand for building areas down there, and Douglas seems to be a very favorable building spot. So there are new houses, new apartments going up. The old ballpark has been turned into a Highland Development Company has put up a big building, and the entire State Department of Highways is housed there on Douglas Island. And the University of Alaska has taken over the dock and put in for its Marine Institute and another big building there. And all in all, Douglas looks very good. It's had a long, interesting history, but it's got a second breath of life, even without the gold mines, to keep it going. As I said, I grew up there, and then when I finished high school, it was my good fortune to be interviewed by a fellow by the name of Dr. Bunnell one time when he was down to the legislature. And he found out that I was from a big family, and my father had passed away the previous year. Although I was employed running the projection machine in the local theater and making enough to live, barely live on, he offered me a scholarship to come to the University of Alaska, and a part-time job to boot. After a little hemming and hawing and dealing, I consented to come, so I came up to Fairbanks then to attend the college in 1933. Graduated in 37, taught in high school in Anchorage for the next 5 years, and in 1942 I was hired back to be an instructor at the university, and I've been there ever since. So that makes me the second eldest senior member of the faculty at the moment. Dr. Scarland started teaching in 1940, so he's 2 years ahead of me in that respect. So that's my story. It's a little story about my family, a little story about early days in Douglas. And I thank you very much for your attention.
All right. You didn't tell us if you have children or married or...
Well, I would like to introduce my good wife, Ellen Barr Cashin, whom I married either in 1944 or 45. I can never remember which. There. And I have two daughters, Ellen, 18, and Phyllis, 15. They're both attending school here. And had quite an experience here in August. After living on the campus all of our married lives, we moved to town. So we have a home over here. 1027 Gilmore Street, and so now we feel that we're really part of the city of Fairbanks.
Which was the first gold discovery in Southeastern? I always thought it was at Windham Bay. Is that so?
I think there was small strikes up and down there.
Yeah.
There was a lot of prospecting going on. Apparently this mining engineer by the name of Fitz or whatever his name was, Fitz, I guess, had been up there and employed to do mining engineering investigations for different properties. And then he had heard about the Juno. And the Juno was about 1880, I guess, if I understand. So most of my information is secondhand and hand-me-down, but I've always been interested in history. And so I hope maybe the people down in Southeastern will do the same thing here. Record the things maybe more on the ground than me telling about it from a distance. But I think it's good for all parts of Alaska to know a little bit about the other parts, too. Well, that's all I have.
I'd like to ask a question. Would you, by any chance, know how Chicken Ridge in Jim Cumbach's name?
What's the name again, Frank?
Chicken Ridge.
Chicken Ridge? Gee, I haven't heard that expression for years and years.
Well, you've heard it before.
Yeah, but only vaguely in the back of my mind, and I don't know the location.
Well, it was, when I was a kid, up on the hill, you know, where the Russian church was, and along the way.
Yeah.
But I was wondering how it got that name.
I really don't know.
They get their
first
airplanes in there.
The first airplane that I saw was about 1923, And a fellow by the name of Pilot Jones, they called him Pilot Jones, Roy Jones was his name, and he flew up with an amphibian and was taking people up for little pleasure cruises and that sort of thing. And then they had some World War I relics out there, but we didn't get to commercial aviation till about 1932 or 33, the Pan American started running flying boats from Seattle to Juneau, and then they started running the Lockheed Electras from Juneau up to Fairbanks here. Isn't that right, Sam? You'd remember that. About in there someplace. I've got a first cover letter from Air Mail to Juneau, and I think it was 35.
The Alaska Juno, when I was there, they had about 950 men working.
The Alaska Juno was quite, I think that was about its optimum number of men that they had. It was remarkable because of the low-grade ore. What were they running? About 78 cents a ton, and they'd have to put through this tremendous volume of rock in order to to make a profit. Well, witness the rock dumps out there, and it'll give you some idea of some of the volume of dirt they move. But imagine crushing a ton of rock to gain 78 cents. That's what it was running. Were you?
I was through it too in the late 20s.
One of my early jobs was I lied about my age and got a job one time in the mill. 1928, I've got the employment papers to prove it, which would make me 14, but I told them I was 16. But what a noisy place. They'd bring in these to the tipple and dump the rock, of course, and it would come down in the chutes. And they had these big gyratory crushers. And it was my job to stand on a picking belt, and any rock that came through, and they were coming through in chunks, maybe a foot or two in diameter, and the idea was when you saw a quartz vein, you had to pull that off into the crusher, which was right below you, because it was the white rock, of course, the quartz that contained the gold. And from there, then the rock that didn't contain any quartz, it went out to the waste dump. I worked 4 days there, and that was enough for me. I got out of that job, and I swore I'd never go back to the AJ again.
I watched him a lot. I'm interested in doing that.
Oh, what a job.
What was the
Yes, we were always pretty lucky there. The schools started in Alaska. There was no government, you see, until 1884, till they gave us created the District of Alaska and adopted most of the laws of Oregon and made them the criminal code and the civil code for the District of Alaska. But schools came in. Some of the towns were able to start schools, and fairly right in 1901, I think, with enabling legislation for schools to start. And in fact, my grandfather Nick King was on the first school board in Douglas, and that started in 1902, the Douglas School. And there were high schools established almost at once. Fairbanks, for that matter, Edby would know that.
Yeah.
What year did we have a school started here in Fairbanks?
1903, wasn't it, Frank?
About 1904. I don't think there were any prior to 1900, because wasn't any law set up to enable.
When Frank came to Fairbanks before I did, I came in 1906.
Yeah.
Yeah, you came in 3, didn't you, Frank?
No, 4.
Well, it wasn't very long before the University of Washington sent up one of their professors to look over the high schools, and he had no hesitation, I think, in 1912 or so, to give accreditation to the high schools that were operating and accepting. The University of Washington, you know, for years accepted Alaska students the same as they accepted their own resident students. That is, you didn't pay out-of-state tuition either, and that was valid until just statehood, I think.
I attended the first school in Nome in 1900.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That had no state authority. That had just local authority.
That was a city.
That's right.
City of Nome authority.
City of Nome. And there's some interesting things about that, too. I mean, it was entirely supported by city
That's
revenues
right.
and taxes.
That's right.
Although, I think, maybe the the district, or it was, weren't a territory yet.
No, they had no money from any other place.
Then a little later on, I think they gave some liquor taxes to the supporter schools, and tobacco taxes, and that type of thing.
Well, we weren't a territory until 1913.
That's right.
And so there was no territory-wide government until that time.
Yes, and it was the 1917 legislature that really created the Office of Commissioner of Education,
right,
and at the same time created a...
But the high school in Nome was accredited at the... they accredited me at the University of California in 1907.
Is that right? That early. Yeah.
I graduated in 1907 from the university.
Well, I think that...
high school there at Nome.
I think they did remarkably well, looking back.
Each town just went
all out to build the best possible schools they could, and they were certainly dedicated teachers too. My heaven's sake, they were good teachers and thorough, as I recall.
Very much so.
Professor Cashin, you say excellent schools. Do you know what their salaries were?
No, but as I said, that'd be—it's so hard to mention dollar salaries now and compare it to today, because there's no comparison.
In 1913, I went out on a freighter, and it was $1 million freighter, and the captain got $150 a month in his board lodging, and that was big wages for a seaman. And we were paying the highest wages in the world at Nome, $150 a month, or $5 a day in board. That was the highest wages in the world. You get those young Swedes in from Sweden. Well, 1 krona was worth 20 cents. So when you multiply 5 times 5, he was the equivalent. A krona would buy just as much as a dollar in Sweden. So he was getting $25 a day. They just worked themselves to death.
Yeah.
Boy, you couldn't beat them any place in the world.
Well, that's just about all the data I have here, but I do hope that the committee here will try and get Merle Thomas, because Merle has a wonderful collection of photographs of early Douglas and Federal, and I'm sure that he could spin good yarn for us about some of his early days down there.
Did you get anything out of the university that early days?
Well, it was already 10 years old when I got here, but I think it was a good time to arrive, because many of the people that had attended earlier were still around, and of course some of the original faculty were still here, and including Dr. Bunnell and Dean Patty and Earl Pilgrim, still around someplace, I think, and there were 6 of the original faculty, and some of the early students. Edby's brother was the first student ever matriculated out there. And
when did Otto Geist show up?
Otto showed up about 1926. Mm-hmm. He came in to take a mining short course that we used to offer every winter. He showed up. He'd been up on the Koyukuk or so, and came in to spend the winter, I guess, and went out to take the mining short course, and Dr. Bunnell, and he got talking, and found out that Otto knew something about archaeology work and collecting of artifacts, because he'd worked with his father over in Germany when he was a youth. And so Bunnell financed him about $1,000 a year. He bought the grubstake, and Otto devoted his time and spent 2 years, you see, over in St. Lawrence Island. And that's what was the start of the university collection.
Kukulik.
Yes, uh-huh. And did some good work over there that was finally followed up. And so that had been done, of course, before I got here, but they were still, that was still the activity going on.
I have it in my mind that Otto was a navigator in the First World War on the American side.
No, he wasn't. He was a mechanic and a sergeant in the Transportation Corps, and he saw service down on the Mexican border, actually, and with Pershing down in the Mexican affair in 1915, and
Then he went to France, and he stayed over there in 1919. I guess he was driving some of the, he was chauffeur for some of the Wilson and that crowd. He didn't actually drive President Wilson, but some of the Secretary of Commerce or State or some of those. He was attached to the American embassy there in doing that. No, I think he was not a flyer, but he was a mechanic. And
I ran across his tracks up at Pile Lake. He was up there mining.
Yeah.
Early days.
Did we ever have auto? We had auto record here.
I know.
Yes, at an early meeting over at when we were meeting over town.
We recorded auto guys at the university.
Well, we recorded.
That is part of his story, because I read it all.
Yeah, and he, but he recorded for us when we were down in the meeting, the Birch,
yeah,
Birch Park too.
But he did record the other person because we had the time to his
yeah.
Story.
Oh, do you? Uh-huh. He was an interesting fellow. Well, that would be a story I'd like to research a little bit before I give a talk on the early recollections of the university. Although it's very fun, I give a talk similar to it every year. I'm the being one of the old men on the faculty now, they call on me in September to give a kind of a little history sketch for the new faculty to tell them what's preceded them there on the hill. So I'll be glad to work up a little talk on some of the early days of the university for another meeting. But
that will draw a crowd.
Well, thank you very much.
This is a recording in the Chamber of Commerce log cabin basement by the Tananaw Yukon Historical Society, December of 1964. Tape operator was Jim Cassidy.
A talk to the Tananaw Yukon Historical Society by Mr. William Cashin on Thursday, December the 3rd, 1964. And his topic was his early day life in Juneau and a very good report of the old Treadwell mine.